Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Laura Miller will be speaking on ancient Israel and purity. So let's listen in on Laurie.
And just a reminder that as we look into the law, and you know, in the Old Testament, the law of the priests and of the ancient Israel people spans the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But we find most of the law that has to do with purity in Leviticus. And I've written there, Leviticus 11 through 16 has to do with what's clean and unclean, what you need to do to be pure. Leviticus 17 through 26 outlines the consequences of what happens when the people of God do not follow the law and keep themselves clean, or clean themselves when they become unclean. Just a little bit about this whole topic. I don't think, because most of us aren't really scholars in this field, we're approaching the Old Testament scriptures in a fresh way. And I encourage all of us, including myself, not to expect that the Bible is necessarily going to support our presuppositions, particularly in this area that is one that, I asked yesterday, how many people here have read Leviticus before? Wow, there's even a higher percentage today. I'm impressed. It's often something that we don't read because it is difficult to understand. But I encourage all of us to approach this in a fresh way and not to expect what we discover in the Bible to support our presuppositions. Secondly, looking into this is a little bit like overhearing the conversation of people from another culture. Let's see if I can think of an example. I guess what springs into mind is being in the airport in Chicago or New York and seeing people dressed in Muslim clothing and carrying on a conversation in Aramaic or Arabic and wondering, you know, not maybe you hear catch a phrase of English here and there and you think you know the gist of what's being said, but it really takes some knowledge and some effort to really understand what they're communicating. That is what the task of uncovering what the ancient Israel's culture is like, and we're going to explore that. And I've also written here at the bottom, I want to make a distinction between morals and ethics. And morals, mores, vary from culture to culture. And that can be defined as the agreed upon norms of a culture. For example, today in our culture, monogamy in marriage, one husband, one wife, is the agreed upon norm. That's morally what we see as the right way. There have been times in our history, for example, in the time the Levitical Code was first given to the Israelite people, it was actually common for a man to have more than one wife. And not only to have more than one wife, but to have concubines also. Remember the story of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar. And when Sarah couldn't have a child, the slave bore the child. And then when Sarah was able to have a child, Hagar was sent away because the wife didn't appreciate Hagar and her child. So those mores have changed. We have a different moral stance than in that time. And there was a time when Mormons in this country had more than one wife, so it's been also in our country. Ethics, which is what we're going to be looking at, or you're asking the why question. The ethics are the principles upon which the norms are based. So, for example, I said this yesterday, well, I'll ask you, that'd be easier. If our moral understanding of marriage is for one man to marry one woman in our culture, could anyone give me, just guessing, an ethical principle as to why? that would, you would say someone from another culture with a different set of mores is saying, well, why do you limit yourselves to just one spouse? Could anyone give an ethical?
The Jews were, for the most part, herders. Mm-hmm. And if you have a herder society that has begun to settle down, mm-hmm. then you have herd owners who live in a little town, and you have herders themselves who are generally young men mm-hmm. who go out in the field for months at a time, perhaps even years at a time. Mm-hmm. And they don't have any way of contacting them to say, how mm-hmm. wife she'd have to stay behind. Mm-hmm. And so it's up to the owners of the herds mm-hmm. to take care of the women. Mm-hmm. And it's more than just a sexual thing. It's, right. it's a very practical right. Economic right. system.
That's very true.
In the North, where we come from, most of us come from, the people were mostly farmers or farmers and gatherers. And it's impractical to have more than one wife because you only need one woman to bake the bread, and right. you only need one woman to cook the deer after you've dressed
it. Right. So that's helpful because you're looking beneath the romance and love and sexuality aspect of marriage relationship at the practicalities of running a household. And that is, you're right. The household in our time and what family is in our time is very different from what household and family was in the time of the ancient Israelites and also at the time of Jesus. And there's a big shift, I'll be getting into this by the end of class today, in the way the world and the family and the religion was at the time of the ancient Israelites, just at the time of being exiled from Judah and Jerusalem in 5th century BC to the time that Jesus was born into. And so an example of a principle that would explain, there are practical reasons for why we have arrangements the way we do, but we also tend to give principles as to why that's true, even though there are practical reasons. One ethical principle that would be supporting the way we experience marriage now might be equality. Because we could see that if someone today were to say, well, a man would say, okay, I want four wives, I don't care what anyone says, someone might critique that and say, well, that is ethically wrong because there's not an equality here. There's four women to one man and it doesn't seem right. That's what I mean. So an ethical principle might be equality. Another one could be justice. Another ethical principle could be love or compassion. All of those different, those are the big whys. And that's what we're going to be looking at in the course of all of this. One final thing from yesterday is I asked us to, as a community gathered for an hour each day, to agree that not only will I speak from my heart and with honesty, that these will be the rules, the law, for all of us in this time, because I found that on the subject of ethics and sexuality in the Bible, that this is a very live issue in some way for everyone. And I want this to be a place, if you have experience or memories or ideas from this, that you can speak honestly and that it will be confidential, and that it's also okay to disagree. And even though I may get a little flustered, it's okay. I mean, that just happens. And that we respect each other's opinions. Does anyone want to add to the norms? If you think of anything later, just raise your hand and we'll add. I want to say a little bit about the discussion yesterday on purity. And if you, at the end of class, I have a handout that it's actually a summary of the introduction in chapter one of Bill Countryman's book. This isn't a substitute for buying the book. I really recommend you buy it. But it does give a very good description of what purity is. So if you want, if you're thinking about this and you want to take something away, I'll welcome you to take those. Purity in any culture has to do with order and disorder. And it has to do with identity. It has to do with knowing where the boundaries of what it means to be a human being is. One person put it simply, dirt is matter out of place. So for example, if you've had children, you may know that the food on their plate is clean, but the food on their bib is dirty. It's still the same thing. It's just that when it's on the bib, it's out of place. That's the dirt. When we talk about a purity system in the broad sense, it usually has to do with things that pass in and out of the human body. Food, waste, blood that's shed or menstrual blood, sexual acts, and birth and death. And if you think about it, all of those things have to do with boundaries. It's very interesting, the thing about birth and death. That's really crossing a boundary, but it's easier to see with food and waste. I don't think it's violating the confidentiality to say that yesterday it was very interesting. One of the people in the class said that his father was very reluctant to ever talk to him about sex, and it was only on the eve of his wedding that his father called him into the bathroom and shut the door and said, use these, and handed him some rubbers and left as quickly as he could. But it's interesting, the connection between bathroom and sex. And that I've taught this class before, and what is usually true is that there's at least one or two people in the class who equate what they've learned about sex with dirty. And that's just not at all surprising in our culture. But that's also not unusual, because it's one of those places of crossing the boundaries. One final thing about, and if you weren't here yesterday, this may sound very foreign. Actually, I think you all, maybe except for Joe. But we'll just keep talking about it enough, you'll catch on. One way of discovering where our purity issues are is knowing when we have a gut reaction against something. And so an example of that could be when you go to a nice fancy French restaurant, paying $20 or so for escargot in garlic and butter is clean, unless you dribble it on your shirt. But what do you think about slugs on a plate? You know, if maybe you're okay with it, being a naturalist, but most of us have sort of a gut reaction, and that is crossing our purity boundaries. And it's interesting, I remember preaching with a lot of relish about John the Baptist eating locusts. You know, it's actually kind of a fun story. And in some cultures, still, people eat bugs. But in our culture, no. But then, and that is not, it's not just a sanitary thing, it is a purity thing. And we know that because of the kind of reaction.
Well, that was in mind too, because you noted some native populations, for example, tropics. They love those creepy crabs like that because they're a good source of protein. Okay. Nobody ever told them what the thing to eat. They've eaten it for millennia.
Uh-huh.
And we have got this pure food business that's right. Changed our minds of what's good and what's bad.
And you know, I wish we had longer to talk about purity. But you remind me of something. One thing that I've recognized about food is we tend to package our food a lot of packaging, which we now know is not necessarily that good for the environment. We're trying to get away from all of that. But I think that comes a lot from a purity issue. It's, you got your thing in the foil and in the box and the shrink wrap, and Yes, there are. Someone mentioned this yesterday, and I don't want to undermine this. We do know about germs and viruses, and so part of what we think is clean is partly protecting ourselves from germs. There are health reasons, but I really think in our culture we go way overboard in some areas, and that's probably to do with issues of purity. Okay, today I would like to say a little bit more. One thing I've noticed, because looking at Leviticus, when you read about what happens if you have leprosy and all the elaborate rituals you need to do, for example, because it's so easy to look at that as a foreign thing, I'm afraid that I sometimes don't give enough context about why this law was so important for the ancient Israelites. You've explained a practical reason for why marriage was the way it was. There is a context for why the people of Israel and the priests of Israel put so much importance in being clean and in being right and connecting that with being right with God. The Levitical code was written around 600 BCE, and it was written, if you've studied the Bible, you know that there are different strands that are interwoven in the Old Testament, and one of those strands is the priestly strand. This was written by the priests, written down. It had been practiced, but it was written down around the time that Judah and Jerusalem were being threatened by Babylonia, and in which a time in which a number of the leaders and citizens of Israel were being exiled to Babylonia. Prior to that time, for the people of Israel, their religion was based on seeing God as leading them to a promised land. God fulfilled promise by giving them a land, a temple, and a king. And if you know anything about the history of that time, there were these big powers, Babylonia and Assyria, that were constant threats to little countries like Israel and to cities like Jerusalem and Judah. And since the time of King David, which was the first time that Israel had its own king and was able to have enough military strength to protect itself from places like Babylonia and Assyria, from that time until the destruction of the temple in 586 BC, there was this religious tradition of praising God, knowing that God was with them because God was with them in the temple and they were on this promised land and they had their own king. So their self-rule and their self-governance and sense of identity was connected with their religion, and that there was no separation. It was all of a piece. When the temple was destroyed, it was obliterated. The land was salted so things couldn't grow. Leaders were taken from Israel to places in Babylonia and just outside of home. And at that point, the religious leaders, the priests, had to somehow offer something to the people that would replace their understanding of God giving them the promised land and God being with them and their king. They no longer had their king. They no longer had their temple. They no longer even owned the land in the sense that they had before. Now it was subject to Babylonia. So they needed to move from a religion of centering on God in the temple and in the territory to a religion that could help them have an identity and a meaningful life. And I think it went from being more of a community around a place to a community that you could carry with you. So for the people who were not able to be in their home, they could still practice their religion and be connected with other Jews. And this is why the law was so important, because no matter where they were, they could, how they ate, how they observed if they were unclean because they touched a dead animal or had touched a dead body or a woman was menstruating, they had prescriptions of what to do to be clean again. And by observing that, they knew they were right with God. So that was a new way of being right with God. To make that a little bit more personal, I just like to ask the question, if for some reason, that think about how you observe your religion. You know, what are the things that you do that remind you that you are a Christian, that you're part of a community? And think about what is the heart of your faith. And that, when I've thought of that, I've thought, okay, if going to church is not the only aspect of my faith, but it is an important part of it. And if I was, for some reason, our country was like Russia in a certain, back in Russia's history, became a time when you could not go to church, what would you do? How would you practice your faith? And it may be that at that point, what you do on a day-to-day basis, cleaning before you eat, or praying at certain times, that may become a whole lot more important because that's how you would keep your identity. I just like to show you what's very interesting. I mentioned that there are different strands in the Old Testament. And one thing that's really hard idea to get away from is that you pick up the Bible and read Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and it's all chronological and it was all written down chronologically. You can see the basis for the Levitical law all the way back in Genesis, because there are pieces of Genesis that were written by the priests around this time. So I'd like you to just look at Genesis 1, 29 and 30. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't tell you. This is in the creation story. Would someone read verses 29 through 30?
And God said, behold, I have given you every plant, field, and seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, and you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food, and it was so.
I keep forgetting this is there. Do you notice anything that was left out about what human beings can eat? Yeah. Okay. Now, look at Genesis 9, 1 through 7. Now, the portion you just read and the portion you're about to read were both written by the priestly writers at the time that we're talking about. This, around the same time, the Levitical codes were written down. Would someone like to read verses Genesis 9, 1 through 3?
And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the air, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every living thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything.
Would someone like to read 5 through 7?
Your lifeblood I will surely require a reckoning. Of every beast I will require it, and of man. Of every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly on the earth and multiply in it.
Thank you. So what you have here in Genesis 9 is after the flood, after God, first of all, after people became so corrupt that God destroyed that, but then God makes a new covenant, makes a covenant with Noah. And the promise is, it's sort of like creation again. Before I gave you just the green plants, Now I'm giving you the animals too. And I'm not going to, earlier it says, I'm not going to destroy the earth again, but what I do require is the lifeblood. And the idea behind that is that the blood of all creatures belong to God. The blood is life, and the blood is a symbol, a reminder that the life belongs to God. So central to the law in Leviticus and about sacrifice is the idea of giving God back the life. That's who it belongs to. Someone have a question? And please interrupt me. If you do, I'm just going to keep going. So that as the priests were writing the law and explaining, now they're showing back and they're showing a plan. This was God's plan. And now we no longer have the temple to worship in. We no longer have our king to be the representative of God with us. But now we show our holiness and our relationship to God by giving God back the life that is given us. And human life also. That if, you know, human life is as sacred as the others. Now, there's two... Last night, the question came up about, was the law that had to do with keeping clean and everything, was that a way of hygiene that God gave as a gift? There are scholars who have said that. There are also some other theories about why was the law written this way. Maybe hygiene, maybe it was a way of just keeping them separate from the other religions around them. There have been scholars who've said it's an allegory, that, you know, the dirtiness and the cleanness is really just a way of talking about the vices and virtues that we don't want to be connected with. Those may all be answers, but the thing that I found that seems most helpful in understanding the why and the ethics of this law is looking at the overall law. And if you read Leviticus all the way through and you look at the Pentateuch, you see that there's a concern with wholeness and completeness. When you're trying to see what's clean and unclean, wholeness means being unblemished, and it means not mixing kinds. For example, people at certain points were to sacrifice a sheep as a way of purifying and cleansing. But it couldn't just be any sheep. It had to be a sheep of one color, without a blemish, and it could not have a broken limb or blindness. It had to be whole and unblemished. So the picture of holiness here is that of the whole man or the whole woman or the whole animal. And that's why the cleansing, if something happened to make you unclean, you need to be cleansed to be whole again. There's something else about that. Oh well, it'll come back. Yesterday I started this exercise and we didn't really have enough time, so I'm gonna give it another shot today. And what I'm gonna do is you're gonna be getting a description of a character who would be an ancient Israelite. And then there's a scripture at the bottom that in Leviticus that you can look up. And what I want you to do is, as you see this character, look up your section, look up your passage and see, are you dirty or clean according to Leviticus when you read your character? And if you can see what you need to do to get clean, and then to just think about, and you may want to, we'll just talk about this together, how do you relate to those people around you? Say, we're going to start, if you find that you're unclean, we're going to start in the unclean state. And just think about the impact it would have. For example, if you're a wife or a husband and you're unclean, are you going to be able to go near each other? Or if you're a mother, are you going to be able to be near your children? If you're a priest, are you going to be able to make So think about how you relate to those around you. And then I'll ask you, after cleaning, how do you feel about that? So I'll just ask you to take a... I hope you can read them. I spread out paper without scribbling. Something I've crossed out from the
front of the room.
If you really hate yours, you can tell them that I'm going to betray you. You're stuck with your role. So, first of all, are you clean or dirty? And can you tell what you need to do to be clean? And thinking about being clean, too, recognize that if you have to make an animal sacrifice, that some animals are more expensive than others. And so part of what goes on here is a real giving of resources. If you have to sacrifice an ox, well, I don't know if there's any that are that big. Sheep and doves are the big ones, or the ones you see a lot, but it's going to be more expensive to give up a sheep than it is a dove.
I've often thought of this, and I'm wondering if today we're the same way. Huh. If we have something to get rid of, we get rid of the imperfect. Huh. I'm wondering if this wasn't just one more way to, back in those days, you just don't get by with giving off what you want. It's what I want. I want a perfect sacrifice. I don't want what you would normally give me.
Huh,
that's the way I've been thinking of it.
Yeah, so the thing about giving unblemished is like giving the best.
That's right.
I think that's good. I think that there's probably a lot to that. Anyone willing? You don't have to. Just explain who you are, and if you're dirty or clean, and what you would need to do.
I have 5 cattle, 4 cows, and a bull. And I've just found 2 bulls of another breed. And the question is, do you let them impregnate your cows? Well, Leviticus 19:19 says, "You shall keep my statute. You shall not let your cattle breed different kinds." Of course, we've come a long way. They artificial insemination and breeding to get better strength.
That's right. What the prohibition in that law was against mixing kinds.
That's right.
And is the verse right after that about mixing seeds?
Yep, mixing seeds, same way. You shall not sow your field with 2 kinds of seed. Or shall there come upon you a garment of cloth made of 2 kinds of stuff?
Mm-hmm. Now that seems strange to us, and you know, when I wrote down his character, I thought my frame of reference was, wow, wouldn't that just be the pits? You know, here's the economic possibility of having more calves. But then I started thinking, but you know, probably for a righteous person following the law, it may be seen instead as, here is my opportunity to worship God, and I know the law, and while yes, maybe I could be richer if I bred these bulls to my cattle, but I'm glad that I have this law and I'm able to observe it. Does that seem like that might be the perspective?
The law in those days, I would think, but if you make an exception one time, well, that would give the person who thinks, well, I don't have to do it here, but I have to do it here. And this way, I think it's good.
Yeah.
Everything is the same way, in the same That's right. way.
That's very good. And one thing I haven't mentioned is, when we talk about law, we tend to think of it as certain rules that apply to one area of life, like don't speed, you know. But law for the ancient Israelites was very, it included everything. It was included religion, it included family life. So you're right, you can't make an exception here because then everything would break down. somebody...
The prohibition against the seeds is kind of interesting too, because one of the problems they have there today and have in those days was the plant that they called tare, which resembles wheat. And if it's harvested along with the wheat, it's impossible to tell the tare seed from wheat seed.
Right.
And so it was necessary, if you're going to have a pure wheat crop, you've got to get the tares while you can still identify the leaves.
Right, right. Otherwise it's poison, right? I mean,
well, it's not poisonous, but it's not wheat.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I was going to say, well, like you said, he might feel good about following his and all that, but mine is a little tough.
What's yours?
I'm a Hebrew woman with a newborn son. Mm-hmm. So, maybe their mental, obviously their mental apparatus is different, but this law says that I'm unclean for 7 days until my son is circumcised, and then I have to spend 33 days of purification. That means that I can't go to the temple, I can't touch any hallowed things.
I think you could be with your son. I'm not an expert on this, but I think what it would have meant was you probably would have been with other women and your son, but you probably wouldn't have, your husband and male relatives would not be around you then. And certainly no upstanding priests would come anywhere near, because you would make them unclean, and then they would not be able to do their task in the temple. So yeah, that's a tough one.
Just the idea, it might not be so bad having to be relegated to other women and raising the children and all that, but just the whole idea that you're unclean.
Yeah.
People can't come near or touch you.
Right.
That's pretty hard.
But eventually you'll be able to be clean, and be...
And it's even worse if I have a female child.
Well, read it if you have a female. someone has
2 weeks of the female child and something like 66 days.
Did someone get that? Did someone get a role for having a female child? Oh, okay. So 66 days, it's twice as long,
yeah.
Right? There's something in that. It shows the roots. not only the roots, but some of the problems with oppression and inequality among men and women we experience today was even more so then.
I'm definitely unclean.
What's yours?
I'm an Israeli priest who's just become crippled by a rock crushing his foot.
Okay.
And so I can no longer perform sacrifices or eat bread. My life is just practically ruined, and I can never become clean.
Yeah.
There's nothing I can do to become clean.
That's a really sad one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing about being blemished, that he's no longer whole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
However, I can receive the bread of God and the Holy Ghost, but I can't approach the Holy of Holies. I can't do any of the things that I did before as a priest.
Okay.
It's a good thing it wasn't his testicles, though, because then you wouldn't be able to be an Israelite anymore.
Wow, that's... You want to be careful in that.
There is prohibition against men with crushed testicles being Israelites.
That's right. You know, there's a really interesting passage in the New Testament, one of the mysterious sayings of Jesus, and I don't know where it is, but something about the eunuchs. Oh, well, I'll look it up and tell you another time.
No.
Man, what do you mean? Do you remember what the quote is?
Probably 18:19. If you can be a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom, hurry.
So that, that's we're going to get into what Jesus had to do with purity, but that is a good example of reversing some of this long, long history of the cleanliness barriers. And that when you understand this thing about the prohibition of having crushed testicles or crushed limb, you really can understand better what that's about. Someone else have a a role they want. You don't have to.
I think mine is somewhat questionable as far as the cleanliness. If I'm a Hebrew man who has slept with a female slave of my own, who is, though, betrothed to another man, and the law reads, we shall...
Betrothed to another man?
To another man. My slave. If a man has sexual relations with a woman who is a slave, designated for another man, but not ransomed or given her freedom, an inquiry shall be held. They shall not be put to death, since she has not been freed. But he shall bring a guilt offering for himself to the Lord at the entrance of the tent of the meeting, a ram as a guilt offering. And the priest shall make atonement for him with the ram of guilt offering before the Lord for his sin that he committed, and the sin committed shall be forgiven him. Hmm.
So it is a little ambiguous.
Kind of
questionable.
The situation.
At the very least, there will be an inquiry.
Yeah.
And part of what that one touches on, we're going to talk just a little bit about property, but not all of the laws don't just have to do with purity. Part of the laws have to do with property. The slave would have been property.
There's no reference to her purity at all because she was just a slave.
Right. So. Right. Yeah. She would not have necessarily even been concerned with being clean. She may have even been a Gentile. You don't know. And that's something I haven't said before, that Gentiles were considered by the Israelites as irredeemably filthy. I mean, there was nothing they could do to be clean, and the boundary of Jews and Gentiles was circumcision. So there was a real clear distinction. And what's interesting is, as you notice, that would only do for males. But that's partly because in many ways, this law and this religion was focusing on the men. Now, women are part of that, you know, in terms of childbirth and, but
you fully as clean as
right, and also the specifics addressing for what women can or can't do just aren't there, because women were not so much in the public realm. Women were not priests, obviously, but there's a lot of things that aren't addressed in the law that we would ask of it today, because we have women equal with men. And so I'm going to, do you have any other questions or issues that this raises? Because what I'd like to do now is jump about 600 years or 500 years and talk about first century Judaism. We now know that the Levitical law was written down around 586 or 600 BC. So we're gonna, and for Jews, throughout that time, that they had this law as a way of identifying themselves as people of God, as a way of living holy religious lives. And what happened is they moved and were moved to different places. This was a common denominator. However, by the time that Jesus was born in the first century, the shame of this law and how it was practiced had changed many, many times. And it evolved, as religion does. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. I'm just going to say that by the time of the first century when Jesus was born, there had been sects, S-E-C-T-S, that had branched off over ways of interpreting the law. And just, you know, it's interesting, I like to make the parallel of denominations. You know, at one time, there was variety in the early church, but as doctrine was formed and as scripture was canonized, there were different interpretations and different ways of understanding what you needed to do to be right with God. And exactly the same thing happened in these 500 to 600 years in Judaism. By the time of Jesus, the majority of the Jews did not live in Judah and Galilee. They were spread out. Many of the Jews lived in the Roman Empire. And so in these 6 centuries, Jews had been subject to other rulers and had been living in other cultures. So you can understand why there would have been so much difference in interpretation. Because people's education was different. They were coming in contact with different people. And they were constantly trying to figure out, okay, what do we make of this? You know, how do we continue to live our lives according to God's law? And I'm going to just talk about, very briefly, 4 different sects, S-E-C-T-S. One was called the Fourth Philosophy. And this was a revolutionary group that was political in its understanding of the law. And its aim was to restore the independence of Israel. So after 6 centuries of being subjugated by other rulers, their way of interpreting the law was very much political, wanting to be independent again. We read about the Sadducees. That was another sect. And their way of understanding the law, it was mainly, the Sadducees were mainly priests, and they had a very strict and literal interpretation of law. So they were being very literal and very strict. A third group that we know more about were the Essenes, and some of you may know about them. These were priests who withdrew from the community and were hermit-like, living in a desert. And they saw their goal was to be entirely free of the dirtiness of flesh and to live pure lives, which is why they withdrew. And they saw themselves unique. So they didn't, in other words, they saw other Jews as forsaking the right way. And only Essenes were now living the true law. And again, it was, they were withdrawn. They were very concerned. And there was a real division between body and flesh and spirit and purity. And finally, the one we probably are most familiar with were the Pharisees. And these were not priests. The Pharisees were not priests. They were laymen. But their focus was, they were legal experts. They would be our most dedicated lawyers today. And their focus of concern became on food. What food was clean and unclean, which of course we've seen, or the roots are in the Levitical passages. So they formed a very, very tight community with clear boundaries. And not only were they concerned about the food, for example, suppose you were a Pharisee living in a Roman community. You would only buy your meat from someone you knew made it clean and sacrificed, or, you know, saved, gave the blood to God. You could not shop at a Roman shop. You had to eat clean food. It had to be prepared properly. And not only did you have to eat the right food and it had to be prepared properly, you could not eat at a table with unclean people. You may know in Acts, there's a passage about, there's some disagreement over who's going to be eating at the table. And I remember my younger understanding was that it was some people were just eating too much, but I've come, and it was like causing a problem in the community. But I think what it might have been about instead was that some people were coming more from the point of view of they can't share this table with someone who's unclean because it will make them unclean. It will violate their holiness. So what the Pharisees did is they created a whole network of associates, people they could eat with. And ordinary people, even ordinary Jews, were unclean and unholy because they didn't eat properly. This was a big problem. This was a barrier. I think by the time of first century Judaism, the gift of law that had been given as a way of allowing people to express their devotion and holiness and connection with God, by the time of Jesus, it had become splintering and it had become a barrier to people being in community together. It's one of the reasons why in all of the Gospels, I believe, It's shocking for Jesus to eat with the prostitutes and sick people and tax collectors. My husband and I argue about this. My understanding, what I've read is that it was actually considered sinful to be unclean. That sin was being unclean. And that Jesus, by associating himself with sinners and unclean people, was making himself unclean and sinful. Or that was the understanding of the religious leaders who were very focused on purity.